Hey listeners, it's David Chen. Got a special treat for you today, an in-depth bonus After Dark interview with the directors of the new Final Destination movie, Final Destination Bloodlines. Had a great time talking with Adam Stein and Zach Lipofsky about the making of this film, how they got the job, what it was like to direct their first big studio horror film, and breaking down some of the gory kills in the film. Now, I have tried to keep this spoiler-free and only refer to stuff that is in publicly released materials like the trailers and stuff. However, if you are spoiler-averse, I would recommend you watch the movie first, which you should do anyway because it's a fun movie, before you listen to this interview. So there are going to be some plot details from the movie in this interview. If you are spoiler-averse, do not listen to the interview until after you've seen the film. Of course, I have to mention, if you want to get more bonus episodes of the Filmcast and get episodes like this ad-free, become a patron at patreon.com/filmpodcast. Really appreciate everyone at patreon.com/filmpodcast who helps to keep this show going. Without further ado, here's my chat with Adam and Zach. Adam Stein and Zach Lipofsky are the directors of the Kimpossible live-action Disney film and the sci-fi thriller Freaks, which is available right now on Netflix in the United States. Their latest movie, Final Destination Bloodlines, is the sixth installment of the popular Final Destination series, which will be on theaters on May 16th, 2025. Adam and Zach, after the success of your last film, you probably had your choice of many film projects. What made you want to tackle the Final Destination franchise?
Wow. Thank you, David, not only for having us on the show, but for that glowing vote of enthusiasm on how many projects we were offered.
I'm not sure you have a realistic idea of how Hollywood works by that question. We don't walk around and go, yes, I think I'll take this movie next.
All right, let's try to be nice, guys.
Our indie movie Freaks, you know, it was well reviewed and people found it on streaming, and it definitely exceeded our expectations for how much people love that movie, but it didn't exactly lead to people, you know, wanting to throw millions of dollars at us. It was sort of a long process of trying to find our next job. And it wasn't until, you know, a few years ago when we heard they were making another Final Destination that we forced our way into the room and made them pay attention to us and listen to what we would do with the movie. And very, very grateful that, you know, we got through to them.
Yeah. I mean, most people probably don't know that, like actors, directors basically audition to direct movies, especially big movies. And so they started with hundreds of directors on a list, and they kind of met with people and they whittle it down, and there's different levels of meetings, and eventually it gets down to like the final few, and you're kind of trying to convince more and more important people to pay attention to as you go through. And then we were obviously big fans of that world, and especially as filmmakers, Final Destination is really unique as like a cinematic sort of craft, because death is never really personified. Death is essentially the filmmaking.
Yes.
Coming for people.
I was going to bring that up later. Yeah.
That's why we're such big fans of it. And I think that's why it's so popular with film people.
Yeah.
Is because of the craft that goes into creating the Rube Goldberg kills. It's really death by insert shot.
Right. That's right. When somebody's watching a movie, typically that experience is mediated by a lot of things like the actor, right? Yeah. Between like you and the director. But like with Final Destination, it's just you watching what the director wants you to see. Basically, right? Like, and there's nothing to distract you from. This is what the director is showing me, and it's the director that's driving this action, right?
And there's such joy to it too, because, you know, part of, I think, what people love about Final Destination is that death is so clever with the way, you know, he comes to kill people. And it's really us that is being death, you know, that we get to plant things, that we hide from the audience, misdirect, surprise them, and then bring things back later, you know, to ultimately kill the characters.
What is your favorite Final Destination kill and why?
That's of all not time. Your movie. For me, I think there's a few that I would put at the very top. I've always loved the little kid who gets crushed to death in FD2, I believe, as we tried to homage in our film. Mm-hmm. There's a kid that we crushed to death. And then I think, to me, there's what we call the spaghetti death, which is in FD2 as well. There's a character who throws spaghetti out the window, and you kind of completely forget about the spaghetti, and all these other horrible things happen to him. His hand gets stuck in a carburetor, his kitchen gets lit on fire, all that, and then he finally escapes it all, and what gets him is the spaghetti. And just the kind of the callback nature of that, which is so much fun, is something that I've always loved and we tried to do in our film as well.
The for me, the screw on the balance beam sticks out as just masterful levels of suspense. You know, you're watching this tiny little screw and you're watching feet miss the screw just for such a long time, and it builds such suspense. And the fact that you're squirming in your seat and covering your eyes as nothing is happening is just a testament to the masterful, you know, suspense building there. It was a bit of an inspiration when we started the shard of glass in the cup sequence. Yes. You know, create some small object that makes you cringe, but then the other masterful part of the screw on the balance beam is it isn't what kills the character. It almost has nothing to do with what kills the character.
Right.
It just trips the dominoes that lead to the character's death. So that was another inspiration.
I'll just share my own just for your knowledge. Final Destination 2. I'm a simple man with simple pleasures. Final Destination 2. Log through guy's
head.
Well,
of course.
You know? I mean,
the opening sequences are like in their own category.
I didn't know we could count those.
I mean, yes.
Once you're in the opening sequences,
I mean, yes.
That's a totally different.
You can't beat the logs.
Okay, fair. Okay, yeah. Okay. Then I
favorite,
will say.
When you say favorite death, it excludes all openings.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't know the rules for my question. By the way, really interesting talking about these movies because you sound like a psychopath, you know, when you talk about what you like about the movies. But okay. I want to talk about how you got the job a little bit before we move on. Apparently, you were chosen from, according to Wikipedia, over 200 directors tried to get this job. You got it. It was in large part attributable to the Zoom meeting that you had with the execs at the studio.
Yeah.
Have you told this story? Have you told like the full story yet?
I don't think we've ever told it on a podcast. Especially, told it to some like.
Yeah, I would love to hear the full story.
Sure.
How you conceived of this and what actually ended up happening to get you the job to direct the new Final Destination.
Yeah. So as Zach was mentioning, you know, you kind of work your way up the ladder in the pitching process, you know, through different rounds of callbacks, and. We had been doing that with the producers and the lower execs and then the upper execs. And it came to our final meeting with the entire team at New Line. And it was down to us
and
John Watts. And yeah. And it was down to us and one or two other directors who were having that final round. And we kind of realized that we had to do something to kind of seal the deal and stand out. And also to the hardest thing in these pitches to get across, because you're showing images and you're talking about the characters and each sequence, the hardest thing to get across is tone.
Final Destination has a really unique tone that's really, really hard to get right, because it's both horrific and tension filled, but it's also fun and surprising, and you think you know what's happening, but then something else happens. And like, if you just say, we're going to make it surprising, like that doesn't really come across in a pitch.
Uh-huh. Noted for my own pitches. Thank you for that.
Zach actually came up with the idea to do this based on a friend of his who had used the background feature on Zoom, the virtual background, where you can put you can add any video to the virtual background feature.
Yeah, my friend had like pranked people during COVID, where he recorded a video background with his chair empty of him walking around in the room, so that then while he was on Zooms, he would be sitting there talking and then a duplicate of him would walk around in the room behind him and like listen to the Zoom and walk out and stuff to see if people would notice.
And so we realized we could be live on Zoom while crazy shit was happening behind us. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he had that idea, it kind of sparked this creative conversation and it made the pitch process, which can be a little bit, as filmmakers and actors in your audience know, that process of trying to, you know, work your way up to get book the job can be so depressing sometimes and can feel kind of non-creative sometimes. So as soon as Zach had that idea, it sort of sparked this creative conversation and these creative juices. It was like, yes. And then it's like a little filmmaking project that we're doing to make this video where behind us at the end of the Zoom, the my house catches on fire, and we ran out of the room to go get fire extinguishers, and Zach turned on the ceiling fan to air out the room, and we're putting out the fire. And then we sat down back at the Zoom and apologized.
And everyone's like, at that point, they start applauding, being, oh, that's funny. You lit the room on fire.
And, and then the ceiling fan fell down and chopped my head off.
Nice. But that was not done practically. That was like the fake background.
Yeah.
That
so
you
we,
put up there, right?
It was quite a comp. It was actually a lot more complex than it might sound, even though that sounded difficult to do. Where
it sounds
basically
complex,
the way that we pulled it off, because we wanted to make sure it was seamless transition from completely live all the way through to live at the end, so that there was no moment where that looked like we went to recorded footage.
Right. And
the way
you have to like wear the same clothes
right,
as
so
you did in the other
not
thing,
only that,
right,
yeah. But we filmed the element that was being played on the virtual background 24 hours earlier so that the sun was in exactly the same position in the
brilliant
room. So that, and what the way we did it is while we were on a slide, we turned on virtual backgrounds. And the reason we did it for that is because it shrinks your video down quite small when you're on a slide so that they wouldn't see the moment that the virtual background clicked in. And the virtual background video started with just two empty chairs and a normal wall, so that us live were now composited in front of those empty chairs. And then as the room started to catch on fire, we got up and left frame as our recorded selves entered frame, which is called a cowboy switch. That's often how stunts are done.
Also known as a Texas switch, I believe.
Texas switch, right. And so our recorded selves entered, did all the stuff with the fire, the kind of head getting chopped off. And then Adam fell out of frame. I dived out of frame. And then my live self re-entered frame and put my hand over the lens as if I was grabbing the camera or grabbing the computer, like in a chaotic moment, while Adam was hiding under the chair, turning off virtual backgrounds so that by the time my hand came off the lens, it was back to fully live.
And because virtual background doesn't play sound, we also had to play all the sounds on a separate system where we had to hit play at the same time as starting the virtual
background.
So that
the microphone on the primary computer would pick up the speakers of the secondary computer.
I see. So you did that like lo-fi where you had like had speakers broadcasting into a mic. Yeah. I've definitely done something similar before. Anyway, bravo. I've always wanted to hear the story. Bravo on pulling that off. That's incredible. And obviously it was worth it. So great job.
It was fun.
Okay, let's talk about the Final Destination Bloodlines. One of the things I appreciated is that this movie tries to add to the mythos of the franchise.
Yeah.
And so can you talk about like what you wanted to add to the lore of Final Destination and how that drove the story?
Yeah, we approached it in kind of several different ways. One was one of the biggest obstacles with a Final Destination movie is to some degree there's a template that the audience is expecting.
Yes.
Which make the movies great. But at the same time, you want the movie to be unpredictable. We love the feeling of where you have no idea where the movie's going next. And all the previous Final Destination movies kind of fit a very specific kind of order of events. And so what we were really excited to do was find a way of changing the formula in ways that didn't break the canon. And so we kind of mess with how the premonition works, where it kind of comes out of someone else's eye. We kind of play with how long death has been, we have many more hundreds of people die in the opening premonition so that death can take a much longer time to come after certain people. We still have an order, but it's a slightly different way of the order working because everyone's related. And all of those were different ways of kind of allowing fans of the franchise to have an experience of being delighted by not knowing what's going to happen, even down to the point of having set pieces where you don't know which character is going to die, which is quite unique. Most of the other franchise entries, it'll cut to one person in a room and you know that person's going to die. And even the one time that we do that, there's a surprise. So we're always looking at how to like take what's come before and honor it, but also twist it in a way so that it's unpredictable. And then the other kind of main thing that we wanted to do was kind of elaborate more on Bloodworth's sort of backstory and kind of give a lot more of a beginning to his character as well as an end, working really closely with Tony Todd to kind of explore how to kind of progress his character a little bit into the new age of horror that we're in now and less away from sort of some of the tropes that he's been a part of in the past. And so that was really powerful and really exciting to kind of do with him.
Very cool. I want to rewind a little bit, actually. You know, there have been multiple reports of different versions of this movie. One point, Tony Todd said they were going to film the next two back to back, but that was like 20 years ago when he said that. There was supposed to be one that was supposed to be about like EMS first responders and stuff like that. When you came onto the project, like, was any of that in play, or did you kind of start from scratch for your?
It was all we got involved after all of that, but we know a little bit about it, so we can kind of, you know,
give you the scoop,
shine some light on it. The first responders concept was an interesting one that they were, you know, really close to filming, but it was right before COVID, and I think when COVID happened, the idea of a bunch of first responders being marked for death kind of put a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
And basically
can't imagine why.
Yeah, basically killed that concept.
Yeah, but then this concept came from John Watts, you know, who did the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies and many other things. And he is a big FD fan. He basically met with New Line and said, if I were to ever do anything with you guys, it would be Final Destination. And here's what, how I think it should go. And he came up with the idea of starting it in the past, having it all based around a family, with one older character who had survived for decades, and death coming after the family tree. And with that sort of essential, you know, seed is where the new iteration was born. And John's focus, which we really loved and are very grateful for, is basing it around a family makes it a lot more emotional and a lot more grounded than the previous versions of the franchise. Like, as
which
much
are mostly
fun,
with straight, which are mostly like an assortment of strangers. Brought
exactly.
Together.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. A bunch of strangers or a bunch of teenage friends or whatever.
There's something that happens in the previous movies that we called the Who's Next issue, which was like someone would die horribly and then they just turn to each other and say, who's next? And like have no care for the previous person that had just died.
except and one of the things that really attracted us to this idea is in Final Destination 3, with Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Amanda Cruz characters who are sisters in the movie, there's a relationship there in FD3 where I always found that relationship and those deaths to be a lot more gripping because they're sisters and they care so much about each other. And they're not really getting along, but they still, you know, she still wants to save her life. And so you saw how powerful that could be. Now with the whole family, you know, and this was John's insight, the stakes are just way higher. Mm-hmm. And you start to be able to have characters that have more dimension to them.
Very cool. I live in Seattle and there is a popular tourist destination here. You may be aware of it. It's called the Space Needle. And I noticed that in Final Destination Bloodlines, there is a similar but legally distinct structure called the Skyview Tower. There's a big set piece that happens there. I mean, I'm kind of curious, why was it so important to set something at something that looked like, set a scene at something that looked like the Space Needle for you guys?
Yeah. Well, we were just designing it specifically for you, of course. That started with a big, of course, you know, a Final Destination opening set piece is iconic. And to be able to be part of getting to decide what we're going to do is just like sort of an incredible dream. And we really started from a place of looking at all the other set pieces that they had done and trying to think of the primal fear that we're preying upon, you know, fear of flying, fear of roller coasters, fear of driving. Like those are very like elemental, primal, relatable fears. And then
the fourth iconic fear of the Space Needle, right?
I have a fear of heights. So we started talking about, okay, where can we put them up high? That would be, you know, where a bunch of people could die.
Plus we know in the late 60s is when they started building all those buildings, all those sort of rotating restaurants and sort of retro futuristic sort of outlook type places. So it felt we knew we were doing a period piece. So that felt really great. Also a restaurant itself is a very relatable place for horror because everyone goes to restaurants and we love the contrast of it being this romantic, beautiful.
There was this element in the early script where the two characters are on a date. You know, this young couple that's going to give birth to this whole family tree, they're on a date. So where could you do a romantic date up high? And we kind of came up with this idea of a restaurant in the sky. Now, the Space Needle obviously was very influential in terms of the design. When you go back, you know, one little detail, when you go back and look at what the Space Needle balcony looked like when it was first built,
yes,
it was really harrowingly unsafe. They have this like tiny little banister, which we put into the movie. There's no grating. There's no protection at all. People could just lean right over. So there was a lot of fun to be had.
But
there
we also
too.
Like I visited the CN Tower in Toronto, and a lot of the specific shots were based on my experience of being at the CN Tower. Like there's a shot that's looking straight up as you kind of look at the building, get eclipsed by the lobby. There's shots of going up in the elevator as sort of the shadows are going past their face as they go faster and faster, higher and higher and up. So we tried to make it universal to all the great buildings.
I was in Tokyo at the Tokyo Skytree, and they have a big glass floor thing. So glass floor was part of it. We just tried to pack it full of as many things to inspire a fear of heights as we could think of.
Have you guys been to the Space Needle by any chance?
I've been under the Space Needle. I haven't been up into it yet.
Well, it's accurate that when you go up it, they're like, this elevator is moving at like 80 miles per hour, you know, and it's like going up there so fast and it can be really terrifying. So I want to talk about a couple kills that you can see in the trailers. There's one set piece where a shard of glass gets stuck in someone's drink. Can you talk about how you put a kill like that together? Do you start at the end point of where you want the kill to end up and then work your way backwards, or you start at the beginning and then just kind of like explore from there?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that specific kill.
Well, we definitely had the idea of the shard of glass in the ice very early on. It was sort of inspired by that screw on the balance beam kill of having a small object that feels dangerous and cringy that you just feel icky about. But we love the element of Russian roulette to it, where you know someone in this family is going to die, but you don't know who yet. Because that really added a new dimension to an FD set piece of the suspense of not knowing who's gonna have the dangerous cup. In terms of what actually ends up killing him in the end, I think that came a bit later.
Yeah, I mean, what we're really proud about that sequence that you might not notice until a second watch is that all the family members do one thing to lead to the ultimate death. So each family member plays a role. If either one of them hadn't been there, it wouldn't have led to the way that the final character finally dies, which was a really fun sort of extra level.
And they're all complicit. They can all blame themselves for what happened because they all had a hand in it.
And as far as how you build these sequences, it's a massively complex, many year long process of brainstorming. So, you know, we work with the writers, we work with the producers, we work with the whole crew to constantly be throwing out ideas of what are different objects. Okay, we're ruining a backyard. What's in a backyard? What are all the different things that could be there? How could those things interact? Okay, let's see if those things physically actually do interact in that way. Let's see how could a rake touch the top of a lawnmower and hit the safety bar so that it pulls it down in a way so that why would that rake be moving? And again, let's think about that. And you just you go around and around and around for years for all of the different set pieces, trying to figure all those different pieces out and then testing it with audiences to see at which point did they get too far ahead? At which point did they predict what was going to happen so that you can then dial that down so that it's always right on the verge of being surprising, but inevitable.
But the idea of using a shard of glass and then having him killed by not the shard of glass, but by something else. I think that's kind of where we started with.
Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. When I was seeing the hose fill up, I was just like, this is incredible. You know, like, because the hose, it's like filling up in such a chaotic way, right?
Yeah,
it doesn't, like a hose does not fill up in an orderly fashion.
Right,
and so you just feel like all this chaos like unfolding in a way that's like unpredictable.
The Jenga tower was another element of that. You know, the Jenga, there's nothing inherently dangerous about Jenga. but having Jenga, a tower, which is sort of kind of evokes the opening tower, and then it's toppling and you're just feeling like, oh God, something's going to happen with this. I have no idea what. But then all the dominoes fall.
Yeah. I think one of the experiences I'm excited for you to have, if you so choose, is to see the movie with an audience because they just go absolutely crazy. As these scenes start to build and build and build,
yeah,
you're just hearing people scream and squirm and shout. Right. And when
they talk to the screen,
and like we've had people leap out of their chairs and like cheer as certain people have died. And like, it's quite an experience to see with a crowd. And another thing you might, as a film geek that I know you are, might also really enjoy is that we did something kind of special with the IMAX version of the movie, which is that you get to, you know, choose how IMAX comes to you and brings you in as a creative partner. And they tell you all the different things that you can and can't do with it and stuff. And one of the things is how you go into the IMAX aspect ratio.
Yes.
And a lot of films just cut to it. Some films just are in it the entire movie. And we really fell in love with the sort of animated version of like animating yes. into the IMAX, because it makes it feel more special and kind of participatory, which of course these films really are. And so they showed us some specific shots of films that had done that. One was from Get Out. From Nope. It like pushes through a window and expands. Another was from Creed. As it kind of pushes into the stadium, it expands. And so we built a specific shot into every scene at the moment that death arrives, that pushes forward, so that then IMAX only expands as death becomes present in the scene. And then it collapses when death leaves, when it finally gets what it's come for. And so there's this really fun sort of experience in the IMAX version where whenever it goes into the IMAX expansion, you know that shit's about to go down in a very like fun thematic kind of way.
That is awesome.
Yeah. FD fans love to play along. You know, they love to guess what's going to happen and sort of feel like they're in a omniscient perspective. So to be able to kind of literally see when death has arrived on the scene, it's a pretty fun, limited edition of the movie, because we found out they're not releasing that on home video. So it's only available to see in the theaters.
Wow. Okay. All right. So get out to theaters. Final Destination Bloodlines in IMAX. Just a few more questions. One, I want to talk about the other kill that's in the trailers. It's also on the poster, where a guy's nose ring gets attached to a chain on the ceiling.
Yeah.
Sort of how did that kind of come about? You know, any thoughts on how you developed that kill? Because that was also extremely brilliant, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one, that's actually one of our most traditional FD sequences, because it cuts to a guy alone in a dangerous location, locking himself in. and then, you know, Rube Goldberg shit goes down. But we also, in that scene, wanted to have twists and wanted it to be surprising. And so, you know, came up with first of all, the song is a very important part of that scene.
You guys have some wild needle drops in this thing. I was like, you must have, like, literally half the budget must have been the needle.
It was a big music budget. We're very grateful to Warner but music has always been a huge part of Final Destination, because it's all about the omens, or those things that have double meanings. And so, you know, he turns the metal off and turns on his sad mix, which has, you know, I can't live if living's without you.
Yeah.
And you see this other side of this character. But yeah, we had a lot of discussions about how to potentially kill someone in a tattoo piercing.
It was extremely difficult. That was probably one of the ones where for the longest time, we just had no idea what all the machinations.
You can't really kill someone with a tattoo needle. They're not that long, you know, they're very small.
Like, for a long time, it was that there was a garage door opener that had like a bungee cord that got looped around it, so that the bungee cord got hooked on his nose, and then the garage door started to close, which pulled him up. But it was just like, why is he standing under a garage door? And then like, so it's just like, you're just standing in these places for years trying to figure out all these different,
all the mechanics of it. But yeah, in terms of why the nose ring getting hooked became a thing.
But even physically, how to hook someone by their nose so that it pulls on their nose but doesn't rip their nose off while you're filming is extremely challenging.
Yeah,
and took like weeks and weeks of, you know, R&D to figure out.
One night the producer like woke up in his hotel room and like scratched a little design for this rig on a piece of hotel stationery and brought it in the next morning like a eureka, I found it. And he had like thought of doing like these nose plugs that swimmers use, like glued into the actor's nose and then hooking the nose ring into the plugs so that it could pivot, but you wouldn't see what was attaching it to him.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what it was attached to.
And then is the idea that it's difficult because if something goes wrong, you need it to come out easily.
Right. Like, so also
it can't, you know, you can't actually pierce him. So it had to be
somehow
connected to his nose in a way that looked like it was connected to his nose.
Right.
Even though it's not
a real nose ring.
One of the things they did that was quite clever was putting a magnet within two of the links of the chain so that after 5 pounds of pressure, the magnet would disconnect so that once it pulled too hard, it would disconnect. But it was still a little too safe. And so there were a few key close-up shots where the actor said, take the magnets off. Let's go full chain. Like we need to really sell this. And so like, they went full hardcore and those are some of the biggest, when you watch, you know, the movie, we've had the pleasure of seeing a lot of the night vision of the audience watching it. Cause when you're testing the movie, they always do night vision for all the audiences and everyone in the audience is like covering their nose while watching that scene, which is,
it's like a involuntary, you know, empathetic response. They just like grab their own nose. And, you know, a lot of people also said when that teaser was released, like, oh no, they're giving so much away. I will say there's a big twist that happens. And we always like the metaphor of like, you know, why is death after this guy in this way? It's kind of like a fisherman who, you know, goes fishing and sometimes they don't kill the fish. Sometimes they throw them back. And so, you know, death hooking Eric and then throwing him back is kind of like that.
I have to say my favorite moment from the movie is when you have that classic shot of Eric like backing off into the street and you think he's just going to get plowed, but then he doesn't get hit by the car. I'm like, you guys, you know, I love when you're like interacting with the audience expectations in that way. You know?
That's what was so much fun about jumping into this franchise, especially with how much viral, you know, success it's had over the years and people sharing memes from it. You get to play with the expectations. You know what the audience is going to think.
Right.
Or, you know, we knew right away when we started, we have to find a place for logs in this movie. And, you know,
I'll just say,
I won't give away what happens, but logs will be seen.
Logs are seen. Logs are seen. You know, I saw that Final Destination Bloodlines has one of the most viral horror trailers ever.
Yeah,
176 million views or 178 million views in the first 24 hours, second only to It, right?
Right. And we heard that after 7 days, it was higher than It had in 7 days now. So it's
suck it.
That's right. you're going to regret your summer movie wager choice. I'm telling you.
I know. Go listen to the summer movie wager episode of the Filmcast and you know, props to BJ.
That's right.
Oh, I mean, dude, my wager, I expect to be in ashes in like 6 weeks from now.
That's
you know,
right.
It's going to be a complete disaster. I am curious. This is probably the biggest production you've worked on in terms of budget and scale. And in terms of making the film and the releasing of it. So can you tell me something you've learned during this process that you didn't know before? And I guess I'm asking from both the film production standpoint and also everything that's happened after the film has been finished.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's such a good question. I think from a filmmaking perspective as a director, having more money to make a film makes everything easier, except for one thing, you know, the everything that it makes easier is you have more time. You have more time to prep. Mm. You have more experienced crew that, you know, really knows their stuff that you can collaborate with. You have, you know, the pick of the of anyone you want to work with. You've got everything you can dream of in terms of tools and all that stuff. The thing that is very, very difficult and it takes up more than half your time is dealing with the stress of the machine, especially of the people who are spending the money, because they're spending tons of money on the movie. And so they feel this immense pressure for everything to go perfectly. And as you're proceeding, if there's anything that they sense might not be perfect right away, they get very nervous and start second guessing or, you know, jumping into fear mode. And so it becomes the job of the director, besides making the movie, there's a lot of like managing up.
I would say that like when you're making a tiny movie, all of your stress is, can we even achieve filming this movie and hiring people that even know what they're doing, because you have so little money, but no stress as far as everyone who is there just because they love making movies and they love supporting you. And because they're,
and you are the ultimate boss. You're the ultimate boss. You're the person you need to answer to.
No one's there for any reason other than to create something cool with your group. But then as money goes up, that dynamic changes and your dynamic becomes a lot of basically cheerleading upwards that things are going to be great. And that takes a lot of effort.
And selling your ideas. It becomes more of a process of like, here's what we're thinking of doing. Here's why it's important. And you become more of a salesman of your ideas to the team. Now, all those people are good people. They were just a bit stressed out in this era.
And I will say,
their employment may rely on whether you make the correct decisions.
Absolutely. And I'll say in the end on this film, though, like the final film we have is every frame of it we love, and every frame of it was, we came to a beautiful place of everybody kind of getting behind what the film was. And we were incredibly lucky through that process. A lot of directors, I think, get to the end of the process of making a big budget movie and can't necessarily say that every frame in that film was their decision. And we've had a really, really blessed experience by the end of it. And we're very proud of the movie that, you know, we ended up with.
Yeah. So I think we learned a lot about that process, and also about the testing process that happens in the studio world of like, as you're in post, testing it with audiences and getting scored and all that stuff.
Any big insight that came out of the testing for you that kind of changed
One really big insight you might find really interesting wasn't necessarily an insight for us, but was an insight for the studio, which was that the last movie was 14 years ago. But audiences specific to horror have changed a huge amount in the last 14 years. And one of the things they were nervous about when we went into the process of making the movie was the level of gore. And which was really based on the testing processes from 14 years ago, where apparently 14 years ago, if any amount of blood you held on it for too long, specifically the female audience would completely tank in the testing. And so they would cut back and cut back and cut back and cut away from everything to try and keep those female numbers up. We were like kind of dived into making Final Destination movie. We were just like, we're making Final Destination. Like, we're going to make this movie as bloody as we possibly can. Like, that's why people are coming to this movie, is to see blood on the big screen.
You don't buy a ticket to Final Destination to cut away.
And we did get a lot of sort of safety-ness of the gore in case that wasn't the case, because in the past, with testing, it had not been that way.
You got shots, or you structured the shots in a way that you didn't have to use the gore if you needed to.
Right? And then when, in our director's cut, we went full gore. We put all the goriness that we had in there. And when the testing came back, not only did everyone want all the gore that was in there, but specifically the female audience wanted even more gore. They wanted, it was like, they wanted
out
for blood in a way that, and the movie tested, 10% higher even with women just in general. And so we then went in and added even more gore to the gore that we wanted. And the studio process, they were very surprised that taste had changed. And they're seeing that across all their movies. But there's just sort of a bloodlust that has happened in the last 14 years that we personally kind of think, because we've had a lot of conversations about why that might be, is just that over that time, because of sort of the streaming and sort of elevated television bubble, television shows like Game of Thrones and whatever,
Squid Game,
it is, TV has become a lot gorier.
And much more accessible.
And so I think audiences are used to that, so, to the point where if you're buying a ticket to Final Destination, it better be even more than that.
Right.
And so
I can watch this on Netflix at home.
Right.
Like,
it has to be even crazier than television. And so we were really given the ability to make some of the deaths even more bloody than they were.
I think the best thing about the testing process was that, because we really wanted, from the beginning, wanted this to be a movie that really worked for audiences. You know, this is a crowd pleaser type of movie. And in terms of that, what I was talking about before, in terms of like working with the studio and the stress of that, when it came into post and we actually could get the data of what the audience was responding to, that took all the pressure off, because it was like, look, the audience likes this. Okay, the audience doesn't like this. We'll, you know, figure out some way to improve it. But they were very data responsive too. And basically, like, we all, you know, were very much on the same page in that way in post.
Anything you learned after, like during the release process? Like, this is probably more interviews than you've ever done.
And your this is just so exciting. Like, we're just, it's like a dream come true. The other day we had a meeting at Warner Brothers in the biggest conference room I've ever been in. Like, you know, 60 people around an enormous table with like a presentation screen the size of a movie screen.
With like the entire room had been themed in Final Destination lore. Like, imagine a meeting that has production design. Like, the table has, you know, skulls and peanut butter cups and pennies and
barbecue and like, grills and like they're in the room. But beyond the production design, like the content that they're sharing is all the stuff that Warner Brothers worldwide is doing to market this movie in different countries, across social, across, you know, commercials, billboards, whatever,
and they're
whatever.
Like, this is what we're
and
doing.
And we're like, I can't believe this is like, if that's not a filmmaker's dream come true.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I can't believe we have so many talented creative people working, you know, on this movie.
Yeah, they've made like a Final Destination bus that has all sorts of horrible things that happen if you go inside of it. They're doing like all of these incredible stunts in England and in Paris and in Mexico City, and like just see, and they said at one point there's rooms this big in every country of people figuring out how to get this movie out there, which was just crazy to imagine all the people that are helping get the word out that you don't even meet that are just as excited. And they told us they screened the movie for all the exhibitors at CinemaCon, as well as they said yesterday in like, you know, 30 or 40 other places across the US. And immediately all the exhibitors were just like, we're ordering even more screens because we can't wait for people to see how crazy this is.
So, I mean, I think like Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdi, who run the Warner Brothers film group, I think they are extremely filmmaker friendly, you know, everything they did with Sinners as an example, and they just want movies to succeed in theaters. And it's just like, it's clear with the way they're running, not just the production side of what movies they make, but the marketing team is like on point.
Yeah. That's been incredible to see.
Well, it sounds super exciting. One last question. And that is Tony Todd's in the movie. It's one of his final film appearances. I'm just wondering if you, and the movie is dedicated in memory to him. Just wondering if you can speak a little bit about what it was like to work with Tony Todd. It seems to me and to other people who have seen the film as though there's a meta component of what Tony Todd is saying in the movie. And, in the movie, he sort of comes to terms a little bit with the concept of mortality. And perhaps he as an actor was doing the same thing. Just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what it was like to work with Tony Todd, who obviously was instrumental in getting this franchise off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, we're so honored and grateful that we got to work with him in the movie. He's such a legend. And he had been sick for years. And we didn't know if he would be able to participate or even would be interested. But he kept saying, don't write me out of this movie. Like, I have got to do this movie. He's so passionate about it. And when he came to set, was incredibly joyful to be there. Like, you could just see he was physically weak, but emotionally it was like a highlight of his of his, you know, final year. And he was just so excited to meet all the other cast and to be on set again.
But we were very aware of the, you know, his mortality was very present within the room. And was present when we were writing it, knowing that this, at the very least, would be his last Final Destination movie. We obviously didn't know if it would be his last movie ever, but we knew these movies take so long to make that it would be his last Final Destination movie, so that we had to create an opportunity for him to say goodbye to the character, or at least have this character say goodbye to the franchise. And as we were building the scene, that was sort of our main focus. But then having him there in the room, as you were just saying, his own mortality was very sort of present in the filming of that scene. And he kind of in the scene goes to the door and looks back at the characters and kind of has this one last message. And we asked him in that moment to throw away the script and speak from the heart as far as what is this all about? What is this franchise been all about? But also what is your career been all about? Like, just speak directly to the audience about what's on your mind with everything that is swimming around in your head. And the take that's in the movie is what he said as an improv around life is precious. Cherish every second that you have because you never know when. And the emotion of that he's portraying in that moment, which is with a bit of joy, he's almost saying it. Like, he's really meaning it about how precious life is, really comes across because it wasn't actually a written thing we were telling him to do. It was just us giving him the opportunity to speak directly to the audience. But then he gives a sort of charming good luck in a wink as he walks out, which of course was in the class that he always brings to every role. And it was,
I think the audience can feel how heartfelt it was and how real it was. And that's where the meta kind of comment comes from, because it's really him doing it.
Yeah.
It's him saying goodbye.
And we've heard from a lot of audience members that, you know, they came to Final Destination to scream and cover their eyes and laugh, and they weren't prepared to cry. And a lot of them, you know, get quite emotional in that moment because it's a unique opportunity for an actor to kind of address their own mortality to an audience. And we're really grateful to be a part of that.
Adam Stein and Zach Lipofsky, thanks for chatting with me today.
Thanks so much,
David. Great to see you.